I walked out, and back then you didn't hardly get an encore. And I went out, played my song, and I got to tell you the story on it too. The song I sang was "Redneck, White Socks, and Blue Ribbon Beer." Wearing this big, giant, huge cowboy hat, playing my 335 Epiphone copy.
I'm excited today to have a conversation with my pal. We have a lot in common. We go way back. We spent many years of our early lives going to the same place called the Georgia Mountain Fair in Hiawassee, Georgia. And then as we got older, we started playing a lot of music together. He's probably one of the funniest guys I know. He's an incredible singer, songwriter, guitar player, entertainer, just all around total package, and just happens to be one of my best buddies in the world too. It's a real pleasure to welcome Mr. Jim Wood. Hey buddy, how are you?
I'm good, man. What's going on?
It's pretty good, man. It's good to see you. So I think since the last time I saw you, you have moved out of the state of Georgia, and I think you're living in Tennessee now. Is that correct?
Yep, I live in Madisonville, Tennessee.
Where is that in the state?
Well, it's about 35 minutes southwest of Maryville, and okay. It's from a 411 standpoint, it's about halfway between Chattanooga and Knoxville.
Okay. Beautiful, beautiful country, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's real pretty. If you've ever heard of the Lost Sea, we're like 10 minutes from the Lost Sea. Country music trivia, George Jones' favorite bacon in the world was Benton Bacon and Hams, and that's literally 5 minutes from my house.
Oh, man.
That's out of Madisonville, yeah.
That sounds like a dangerous thing to be close to. That would also be a good claim to fame, that we are George Jones' favorite bacon. That's pretty good. That's pretty awesome, man. Well, I'm going to start by telling a story about me, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'd like to hear the story of yours. But when I was growing up, very early age, my grandparents had a house. Had a weekend place up in Hiawassee, Georgia, Bell Creek area. And every weekend we would go up there. And then 3 times a year for the spring, summer, and fall festival, we would go over to the Anderson Music Hall, or the Music Hall, I think is actually what it was at the time, and would sit and listen to people perform. And at some point, I got up and started singing with the house band there. And for me as a musician, probably one of the most important things that happened to me in my young life. And that's how you and I met each other. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to when you started going over there and what that experience was like for you.
I didn't know you had the place on Bell Creek. My grandpa on my dad's side had bought a place also out on Bell Creek. Literally same out direction, and it was on the lake. He bought it in the 50s when nobody wanted property on the lake. And so even before I was born, there was a tie to Hiawassee. And years and years later, when I lived in Montana as a kid, we would schedule our summer vacations to come to Hiawassee to see my grandpa, Papa, we called him. And it was usually during the fair. And Dad had grown up playing in creeks and branches and stuff when they would come up on vacation with Howard. And so there was some familiarity there. And they started that. We went to the show. We saw the amateur night, what they called it back then, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was just a kid. And then years later, I guess I was 13, maybe. Of all people, Barry Palmer had a college roommate who was a friend of mine from Sutches. That's where I really grew up, with Sutches, Georgia. And this guy Tommy had been telling Barry about me. And he said, you need to tell him he needs to come over and play at the fair. So it would have been October. I was 14. So that would have been like 70, 80, two, something like that, I guess. And I went over there, I mean, green as you could possibly be. Now, let me back up a tiny bit. I started playing in a square dance band when I was 9, but to walk out on the stage like Anderson Music Hall with 3,000 people sitting there, that's pretty green, you know. And I walked out, and back then you didn't hardly get an encore. And I went out, played my song, and I got to tell you the story on it too. The song I sang was "Redneck, White Socks, and Blue Ribbon Beer." Wearing this big, giant, huge cowboy hat, playing my 335 Epiphone copy. And, excuse me, the song I played was Guitar Boogie, instrumental. Well, the crowd went bananas. So Howard looked around and said, you know another? And I thought, well, crap, I didn't, you know. So I did. I said, y'all know Redneck White Sox and Blue Ribbon Beer? And they started dying laughing. So I turned around, and that was the first song I ever sang in public. And then I didn't sing again in public for years. I was just came over there and played instrumentals. And that would have been, that'd have been like 1982.
That was probably around the same time that I was there.
I'm pretty sure, because you would have been about, the first time I remember you seeing you, you were five.
Yeah, I was 5 years old the first time I sang there. So we, like I said, we used to go up there, but also at the same time, we had some good friends and family that played music together in down where near where we lived, and they were good friends with Doyle and Paul Barker, and they all got Doyle and Paul used to come over and play with my aunt and uncle and dad and everybody. So I knew Doyle when I started going up there, and and you know, for those folks that probably don't know who that guy who we're talking about, he's probably the best guitar player that no one has ever heard of before, and in that area of the world, North Georgia, Doyle Barker was, man, he was something else. He played, had that Bixby palm pedal, played through
and
that
the Echoplex.
And played the through Echoplex. The Echoplex. I have a bunch of recordings that I go back and listen to from time to time and hear him play, and it still blows my mind how well he played. It was unbelievable.
Well, I knew of Howard through Dad, even though Dad by then had moved back to Texas, but I knew Howard, and then that's how I met Bill, who, without a doubt, the singular most influential person on my music career and in a lot of my life is, without a doubt, Bill Cunningham.
Yeah.
There's,
I understand.
And
I knew,
I've told him this isn't a kiss up. I'm an infinitely better musician because of Bill's influence, but I'm even more so a better person because of Bill Cunningham. And then, of course, I knew who Chief was. Everybody that played a guitar knew who James Childers was. And then I got to know him better as I started playing over there at the fair. You know, again, I mean, I was 14 years old, and I would walk out there to plug into that direct box. If you were a guest, you didn't get an amp. But by the time I was 15, he was letting me plug into his PV amp, you know. And I thought, well, man, you've hit the big time, you know.
You know,
and then Vernon, we can't leave Vernon out either. Vernon and I got to be super tight. And years later, when I got, it had been 1994, I got really sick with a heart infection. Vernon actually came down and checked on me in the hospital a time or two.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. The people I remember as a kid was, of course, Chief, Howard, Buell Wright that played fiddle also.
I sang at Buell's funeral in Smithville, Tennessee.
Really, really. And then, of course, Bill playing steel. F.C. Collins, who played rhythm guitar and sang. The bass player before Jerry was, well, Jerry, and then before Jerry was Wayne Smith, and then before him was Kenneth Young, I believe was the guy's name.
Right.
Who played, and Terry Swanson played drums.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those were some, yeah.
I mean,
you can't leave, and Barry Palmer.
And Barry Palmer. Exactly.
You know.
I mean, it was, I tell everybody that for me as a kid sitting there in the metal chairs with my grandparents, it was like me watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I mean, it was a formative game changer for me to sit there and watch them play.
Well, I'll quote Barry, because when we retired the band and we gave out the last set of plaques, Barry said to me, and he summed it up, because I totally agree, he said this was his Opry.
Yeah.
And that's what Anderson Music Hall, with that group of musicians, and honest to God, it was overwhelming. I mean, because when I first started playing there, Howard didn't like what I played. I don't know if we can say bad words on a podcast.
You can't go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite stories is he was talking to Bill, was trying to get him to say, hey, cut Jim some slack. Because, I mean, you were always the opening act as a kid. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to follow this five-year-old kid that sang all four parts of Elvira by himself. I mean, you know. And so I'd come out. We'd seen all the country and, you know, the great, some of those guys on Saturday night. I mean, that was a big deal to get invited back. It took me years to get that invite back. And when I came out, you know, everybody had heard all the country music. They needed something different. So here I come out and did Johnny B. Goode and duck walked across the stage and the place went bananas. But that was, and I've got a picture of it. Howard's looking at me like, what in the hell is he doing on my stage? And Bill was trying to get him to say, hey, you know, cut Jim some slack. He loves Bob Wills just like you do. He loves it. And he said, well, I know Jim's a fine musician, but why does he play the shit that he does? So Bill says, well, Dad, he's doing what we're supposed to do. He's entertaining the crowd. And so that kind of started thawing the ice. But then to transition from, and I don't use this word awesome, awful, also awful. I mean, a lot. I can't think of the, but I just short of worshiped those guys.
Oh, I understand. No, I get it.
And then to transition to many years later, and I kind of, in fairness, Chief tipped me off, so I knew it was coming, but Howard has me come over to his house. I want to talk to you about something. So we go to the basement, and I'm thinking, okay, either this is good or I'm fixing to get a shot in the head like the Godfather, you know. But he all of a sudden he tells me he's retiring and he wants me to take over the staff band. And I'm sitting here thinking, that's a long ways from why does he play the shit that he does? And yeah, honest to God, it was overwhelming. I still have the video of the night he retired and handed all it up. And I truthfully didn't know much of what to say. Cause like to you, like exactly like you said, that was my Opry. We were a single parent household. The thought Nashville might as well have been on the moon. And it was all we could do to get from Sutches to Hiawassee in a Chevette. And mom teaching school, I always got one of the late numbers because just before I started the sign up by mail thing, I would get over there. And if I got in the 30s, I was ecstatic. Most of the time I was number 70, 68. I think in my scrapbook, I was number 74 one night on the single night. And to go from that, the Georgia Mountain Fair and those guys, that was the Grand Ole Opry to me.
Yeah. You know, so to back up what the singles night was, and I'm just explaining this for people that may not have gotten to experience it. During the fair, they would have shows every night of the week, and they would have an opener and a headliner, and next night an opener and a headliner. And then on Fridays, the staff band would play a set and they'd take a little break. And then it was essentially an open mic night with a live band.
On Friday nights, there was a headliner.
That's right. That's right. The headliner would play before the staff band.
Right.
And then the staff band would play a set, and then it would be everybody would just sign up. They would come to the back of the music hall, write their name down. They would write down the name of the song they were going to sing, and they might write down the name of the key to the song if they knew it.
And they might have it wrong.
Yeah, I was going to say they might have it right. Yeah. And it was, you know, years later getting to play on stage during all that. It's a fun little amount of stress that you're going to get to back somebody up that's playing for, you know, that's going to go out there and just basically put their self-esteem in your hands. And, you know, it's like we're all holding on for dear life on some of that material that, you know, that some of us in the band knew and others didn't.
Well, and like for me, because I lived on both sides of that, I knew what it was like to walk out there, and I was smart. I learned just because it was a new song didn't mean I should do it. Do something the band knew.
That's it.
Because if we all looked good, we all looked good. And you'd always have people that would come out and do something and get ticked off because the band didn't know it. Well, it only come out 3 weeks earlier. They didn't have a chord chart. Matter of fact, back then, nobody used a chord chart. And then all of a sudden, 1996, 98, I start playing with them more regular. Well, before that, I started filling in on some of the newer songs, like people, the single nights, we'd all jam backstage for hours till your slot came up and somebody said, hey, do you mind going out and playing this with me? So I'd go out, and that just morphed its way into the next thing I know, I'm playing with the staff band, and then I wind up being in front of it. And then the pressure went really nuts because instead of having to be on for one or two songs, but even when it first started, we still had 60 something people.
Yeah.
And we knew the majority of the songs, and I got the idea to start getting the list in advance. We started having people sign up by mail so we could at least prepare and anticipate what was coming. And we would download chord charts, or we'd get you, the master of all time chart writer, or Jerry Braswell, God bless him, the official living legend of our whole circle.
That's it. Yeah.
And Bill Cunningham, I always introduce him as the brains behind my disorganization. That really wasn't being funny. That was the truth. We would get that together. And then all of a sudden now the script is flipped. We're having to do all the songs we don't know.
Yeah, that's it. That's it's exactly right. And yeah, we would be a little bit more adventurous on some of the singles requests because we would do a little preparation ahead of the show, which was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Describe in your memory, what was the Georgia Mountain Fair like in the early 80s?
In the early 80s, it was more still of a festival. The concerts that they had were still more of a festival atmosphere. I remember coming over there and people parked. It was so full. It was so full. It was like feeding the 5,000 with funnel cakes, you know?
Yeah.
And people would be parked on both sides of the road down into people's pastures and ball fields. And they would literally walk a mile, 2 miles to get to the music hall. The crafts were still original and new. And again, you got to remember this is a different time. We didn't have internet. We didn't have cable TV. The world was still a really big, huge place. And there were things that you only saw at the Georgia Mountain Fair. Honestly, it was almost like every summer we had 2 weeks of the World's Fair. And people from Atlanta and all the other people, the ones that weren't afraid of banjos, would come up there and you saw the real authentic mountain crafts and the festivals. I mean, I remember seeing like Randy Travis. I saw Ernest Tubb at the Georgia Mountain Fair when I was in like eighth or ninth grade. I want to say I don't remember. If it was 1976, it would have been my fourth grade. But yeah, I was a kid, but you got to see some of these people like this and it was still very tangible.
I saw George Strait there before he was a massive country star. Yeah,
I remember when he was there, but I didn't make that show. And back to then, I got to see the Texas Playboys under the tent in the rain and mud. And then I got to see them again a few years later. But I mean, that was short of going to space. It was that kind of comparable to, especially if you're like us. And I've learned the hard way. Not everybody gets it about music. I had this discussion with Steve Henson, and we immediately hit it off because we found out we knew like 3,000 of the same people but had never met. The common thread was we get it. And so some people, I saw this. No, we took a day off work. We skipped a day of school. I remember people scheduled their entire summer vacations around the fair in the 80s. And then in the late 80s to early 90s, started transitioning where it started becoming a little more corporate, if that sounds right. And the concerts went from a festival feel to a full-blown concert feel. And then by the end of the 90s, it was really corporate. Now, I'm not saying it was bad. Things change, and that's okay. But in the 80s through the late 90s, that Saturday night show that we got to be part of, that was maybe the hottest thing in Georgia. And I probably should expand that because of the region and probably Southeast Tennessee and Southwest North Carolina. I mean, Rob and LB drove over there for how many years and owned the joint, you know?
Oh, man. Well, you have to imagine I'm trying to think of another venue comparable to it, but it held, what, a couple thousand people inside?
Well, there was always a talk about, you know, depending on how many you packed in there. I was always told 2,000, 2,100 comfortably, $2,900, $2,900 people if you packed them in there. And that was counting those chairs along the sides. But when it was in its heyday, they would roll the side doors up and people would sit on the grass in the bank.
I remember you could stand on stage and those doors would be open and it was a sea of people up the hill. You couldn't see any grass anywhere because there were so many people sitting out there just trying to hear it.
And when we left, we were always, you know, being good Baptists and musicians, we're always the last ones to leave. I can remember looking up there and the grass being gone because so many people had sat down on it or slid down the bank, kids, that the grass was gone.
Yeah.
You know, or in splotches. And, you know, when the crowd would let out, they had the state patrol down there doing traffic because they had to.
Yeah. There were so many, like you said, there were so many people parking along the side of the road. There were so many pedestrians. They had to have someone out there directing traffic. It was insane how many people there were.
It was, and again, that was a yesteryear. Now YouTube, and like what we're doing, a podcast, everything is so much accessible now that people kind of take it for granted. You know, I don't need to ride over there to see this person. I'll just watch them on YouTube. And I get that. I mean, I'm guilty of it too. But back then, it was just short, especially for a kid living in such as Georgia that graduated with 10 other kids, where it was 11 people in my graduating class in 1985. Now, where I lived in such as, I was lucky. I got like 20-something channels on TV. Most people where we lived and up there got two or three. So outside world was almost a whole another country. And to get that brought in there to the fair, it was like those guys were from space.
Yeah.
You know, like you were talking about Dole with the Echoplex. You'd heard that on the radio. You'd heard Chet on the Opry, and I'd worked my face off thinking, how does he get his fingers to move that fast? Well, you still had to have talent, but no, it's a box. It's a delay tape. And then you hear and then Bill. So I know for a fact Bill Cunningham is the first person as a team. I remember some people playing steel when I was a kid, but when you're 9 years old, steel guitar is just there. But I thought, now I know where this sound comes from. And Howard, to me, Howard was such a visionary, for one thing, because he started the music at the fair. But and I'm not knocking any of this, and I always get in trouble for telling the truth, but most folks around there, when I was growing up, if they played fiddle, it was bluegrass or nothing. And Howard, thank God, and I mean this sincerely, thank God, he was as much Western swing, maybe a little more so, as he was fiddle. And he mastered both. And for me, bluegrass is great. Okay. But Bob Wills, and especially having grown up in Texas, I was born in Fort Worth. I spent my summers out there. I got to go to Texas when I came over to hear Howard play Faded Love, because he played them both like they should be played. He didn't play Faded Love like a bluegrass tune.
Yeah.
And that was all right there in Hiawassee, the cultural center of the universe during August back then.
Yeah, it was. It really was. I mean, it was like, and I'll tell you, for this little kid who, you know, breathed music from as early as I can remember, the world stopped for me when it was time to go up there. And I mean, I was a little kid where most kids would be outside throwing rocks into the lake. I sat on my rear end by choice, soaking up every note that I could. And
we had passes that somebody had gotten us wristbands to ride the rides, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting in there. I said, we got to go. I said, no, Ernest Tubb is on the stage. And I sat there and watched Ernest Tubb's show. I mean, same deal.
Yeah. I mean, I was just talking with someone about this experience. I remember seeing, like I said, I saw George Strait. I saw Newgrass Revival there in the 80s. And it just like face melting talent, just unbelievable. Some of the people that we got to see.
I saw Jerry Reed there in 1983.
Man.
Might have been 85. And then 15 years later, I got to open for him.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah, you did that show with us, didn't you? Didn't you work Jerry Reed with us?
I don't know if I did that show, but I believe I was there.
I know you were there.
Yeah.
You got a face that you can't forget.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Unfortunately. So let's back up a little bit. Because you lived in Fort Worth and Montana and such as, so kind of walk me through the Jim Wood path of where it started and what got you to where that 15-year-old kid, what was your geographic path?
All right. You asked for it, so I was born in Fort Worth in 1967. Because my dad was out there at seminary, at Southwestern Theological Seminary, studying to be a preacher. And then when that wrapped up, we actually moved back to Hiram, Georgia for like 6 months. And I don't remember this because I was a year old. But then we moved from there to Sharon, South Carolina, to a church that he got. And that's where my brother John and my sister Beth were born. And we stayed there. The average life expectancy for a Baptist preacher is about 3.5 years, and then it's time to go to the next church.
Mm-hmm.
So Dad got the wild hair, literally, that he wanted to be on the home mission board. So we moved from Sharon, South Carolina, to Whitehall, Montana in 1972. And that's where I started school in first and second grade. And then on a down note, while we were there in 1974, my brother John got killed. He got hit by a car, actually a truck. And that pretty much put an end to the Montana experience. So he was talking to Mom, and Mom said, well, wherever you want to go, that's fine. But I just do not. And Mom is originally from Morganton, Georgia. They're outside of Blue Ridge. And she grew up when nobody wanted to be from Morganton or Blue Ridge. But she said, as long as I don't get put back in the curves, I'll go anywhere. So after John got killed, we moved back to Morganton just for a while to sort it out. And here's where the Hiawassee connection starts fiddling in. So while we're there, Bill and Ann Potts, I don't know if you remember them from Hiawassee and the fair.
I do remember them.
Yeah. Mom and Dad had gone to school with them, and they were big involved in the Notley River Association there in Union County. And there was a church in Sutches needed a fill-in preacher. So they talked Dad into doing it. And that was a really, really bad time in our life because, I mean, John had only been dead not even a year, you know. And so Dad, and there's a reason this, I mean, this all matters to this flow. So Dad goes up there and preaches a couple Sundays, and they decided they want to offer him the job to preach there. So he goes and tells Mom, well, I found us a church. What do you think, blah, blah. And she says, okay, so we rode. And if you've never driven from Morganton to Sutches on Highway 60, it's like doing your own lower GI in an automobile. So we literally, in 1975, we moved from Whitehall, Montana to Morganton, Georgia, to Sutches, Georgia. And that's how I got there. Mom and Dad split up in 1980. Just like I've learned, when you lose a kid, that usually happens.
Yeah.
And Dad went back to Fort Worth. And so that's how my Texas experience just maintains for so many years. And then I stayed in Sutches till 1996 when I moved to Nashville. And then I did Nashville, came back to Hiawassee, lived there from 1998 till 2023, survived COVID in 2020. That was really bad. And then we moved to Madison. My wife Cindy and I moved to Madisonville, Tennessee in June of 2023.
Wow, man, you've seen a lot of the United States as a resident.
Well, I remember this, and this is not a good thing. Sometimes it all depends on your perspective. But when I moved to Sutches and started there at the very last 2 weeks of second grade, then I'm not putting anybody down. But at that point, at 7 years old, I'd been to all but five states west of the Mississippi. And no matter what story I told, it sounded like I was just full of shit, which I can be, but not in a dangerous way. And I gave up. I was trying to explain Yellowstone to folks that it was incomprehensible. And by the time I was 20, I know there's musicians that travel. They've been to all 50 states so many times they don't talk about it. But I had been all over the country except the Northeast by the time I was 25. And I've gone a lot of places with my music. And the highlight to all of this, to wrap it up, to make it even that part, even to make it more relevant to present. Last year, 2023, I got to take Jameson and JC back out west for their combined senior trips. Jameson's senior year was destroyed, which that's talked about in one of the songs of my CD. But so we put her senior trip together with JC's, and we went to Yellowstone for like 3 days, and then we drove back up through where I had lived, and that was the first time I'd been back there in 50 years. And then we drove up to, there's a point to all this, and then we drove up to Glacier. But what we went to the spot where my brother got hit, and I showed them where we had lived and all that. And I was trying to explain why this was such an important trip to me. And Jameson interrupted me. And even though she's 22, every now and then her little kid voice will come out. And she says, Daddy, I've learned something on this trip. And I said, great. She said, you're from a lot of places. And that was my vindication. That's, yeah. My whole life, I've been from a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you pick, you're a sum of all of those places,
yeah,
too, you know.
Yeah,
and
I am.
Musically, as a human being, as a man, as a dad, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I get what you're saying. And yeah, what was that experience, if you don't mind me asking, what was that experience like going back to where your brother was killed?
I snot bubble cried for about 15 minutes.
Sure, of course.
And but it wasn't just over that incident. One of the things I remember everything. I was 19 months old when my brother John was born, and I remember them bringing him home from the hospital. So everywhere I've been, I remembered it. When we were in Whitehall, the kids could not believe how well I remembered every street. I drove straight to the school, and we drove up from the Yellowstone Inn. I drove by a couple of ranches that Dad had worked on. I did miss our house by one alley. I didn't go on the main road, but I showed them the street that I used to walk back from the school. I mean, in second grade in Montana, we walked to school, you know?
Yeah.
And, but I had not seen that spot as an adult, and I had not seen it in 50 years. And it was overwhelming when I realized, 'cause I knew what all had happened starting. and how it permanently changed our entire lives. It'd been our family, my life. I thought about my kid. Now that I've got kids, I realized it not as a brother that I lost, but I understood what it was like with having kids as a parent. And then all of that wadded together, 50 years of all of the changes that really that fuse was lit in Montana. That was, and I'll tell you this, and there's a handful of people know, when it really hit me, it made my head hurt so bad. I literally pounded on the side of my head. It felt like a hot rod had gone through my head. It was just overwhelming.
Well, I can't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like for you. I can't imagine what it was like for your parents. And yeah, it changed the course of everyone's life immediately.
Permanently.
Yeah, permanently.
Irrevocably.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just can't. You'll never know where your life would have been. Had that not happened, but it certainly wouldn't be the way it is now, right?
Well, and that's kind of what, in that song, that senior year, there's all kind of references about hidden scars, and but that's what makes us up. That's what makes us who we are. How that incorporates into your music, you know, you can choose to always be down over those things and you'll have your moments, or you can choose, you know what? I know what it's like to be down. I'm going to do some uplifting stuff to help not just yourself, but to help other people who've been through similar things. And, you know, you're either moving forward or you're dying. There's no such thing as standing still.
Yeah.
And who I am, I make no, I've never hidden it. I had been trying to get back out there for 30 years. And every time I turn around, there was some reason we couldn't go. Somebody just didn't want to go or blah, 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 blah. And to finally get to, I saw God's hand in all of this, because I nearly got to go about 4 years ago with some guys that were going to fish. But I realized when I was standing there, God shut that other trip down because I needed to be there with my kids and with my wife, Cindy, because the kids needed to see that it was real, and they needed to see my reaction to it. And that was the people that I needed to have there, not a bunch of buddies or even other people in my life. I needed to be there with somebody that got it.
And the people that were there with you, it allowed you, I'm going to assume it allowed you to process and grieve in that moment the way that you were supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you the other part of it too, and you get this. This is something I'm not real good at. I'm not real good at putting on a front or a fake or being a facade. And as a musician, that's part of the art of being a musician. How do you buffer transparency with authenticity, but not being abrasive, you know? So there's a lot of our life that we spend with a front up. Mm-hmm. And there for a little bit, I wasn't Jim Wood the musician. I wasn't Jim Wood the dad. I wasn't Jim Wood the songwriter or the comedian, all the other stuff. I was just a human being dealing with something.
Yeah, yeah, you know? that's it.
And that was so liberating, not only the tragedy of it. And I did feel some anger for a little bit about all the people that would not let me have those memories throughout my life. Whenever we're not talking about that, but even just talking about going to Montana or talking like we're talking about other places I had lived, whenever those subjects would come up sitting at a table, I'd get blown off. We're going to something else. And I've learned it's because I either A, didn't want to comprehend it, or B, couldn't.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. And I'll tell you, you know, I lost my dad back in December. And
right.
I've done a lot of thinking about things. And look, I'm not going to lie about it or sugarcoat it. My dad was a very complicated guy. We had a lot of, up until the very end, we had a lot of things that we didn't see eye to eye on. And it was not the best relationship that it could have been. All that said.
Right. Yeah.
But as I get older and as I have children of my own, you realize that your parents were just people. And they were doing the best that they could do. And it's as we grow up, we have this expectation of what we expect our parents to be and what we expect them to do. But for the most part, they're just trying to figure it out the best that
they
can.
There's no handbook.
No, there it's not. And as my, you know, when my kids were little, I just kept thinking, I just can't wait until they get older, because this is going to be a lot easier. And it is completely the opposite of that. As they get older, it gets more complicated, because big kids mean big problems. You know, this is tough, man.
Yeah. Well, I said this one time, and this is how I am. Some people know it, but the shit you clean up for them when they're 6 months old is a lot quicker than when they're 16 and 20.
That's the truth, man.
It's in a diaper. Bam. And your biggest accomplishment is you learned to make the big 3-foot sausage in the diaper, Genie. And you walk, oh, look, I did. And you throw it away. When you get to be, they're 22 and they're calling, hey, what do you think about this class? What do you think? Or when they're 16, my boyfriend broke up with me and I'd trade for a diaper any day.
It's any day of the week.
2-minute job, some hand sanitizer, and you're done.
Yeah, I'd trade for it in a second. Yeah. You know, but I'm curious, through all of this, did you write a lot? Did you write a lot more around this period when y'all took that trip?
I haven't yet. And I'll tell you why, because it's not that it'll all be dark or heavy, but it didn't fit. And I've had some songs forever and I'll write them. I'll probably write them this year. But for the project that I just finished, they wouldn't have gelled.
Yeah.
The truth be told, the album I just did is probably 10 years late. But with what was going on in my life, plus my economy and my job, and I literally did not have the time or the money to get back in a studio. And then when I started getting some of that, COVID hit and shut everything down. And then I got COVID and nearly shut me down. So when I listen to it, though, the project as a whole, I'm starting to think, you know what? In a way, it's 10 years late. But I look at what's going on around us in the world. It may be right on time. And then if I can get it to do well enough, I'll do a new one with some new material. A lot of it from these trips.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great.
And I would say that, and that you bringing that up, I mean, I know what I'm known for. Everybody knows for me playing loud country rock and roll music, and I love to do that. But the other side of me was singing ballads and writing songs with lyrics that really matter. And when I say this just follow me. When we did our shows at the fair, I'm up there splitting time with you and Jerry and the other musicians. We all had to, you know, I did like 4 songs. And Courtney, of course, God, I mean, is there anybody ever been sweeter than Courtney?
I haven't met him yet. No.
I mean, no.
No, they're not.
And but my job, if I sing a ballad, because you and Jerry both just sing the phone book, but when you sing ballads and really show off your voice, it's like, why would I even go in that area code, you know? When you sing Statue of a Fool, when y'all would sing those songs, the air would go out of the building. Well, my job in that role was to sing something to pick everybody back up. So what I'm known for is only about half of who I am. And this album is the other side of me. I mean, there's some up material on there, but the material that I've written, it's all ballads. It's all stories. Dwayne Rowe told me, he said, you're one of the last storytellers. And so that's what this album is. It's telling a lot of stories about life in songs.
I'll be your refuge in the rain. I'll be your shelter from the storm. When the lies of this old world have left you cold, I'll be the truth that keeps you warm. When you're feeling lost and all alone, you've had more than you can stand. I'll be your man.
So I'm curious, because I know, look, anybody that knows Jim Wood, you were influenced by and still are influenced by Stevie Ray Vaughan, the Allman Brothers, Merle Haggard,
James Burton. Yeah.
You know, I'm curious if you're going to sit down and listen to songwriters, who are some of the songwriters that you would say have influenced you?
Oh, wow. I've never thought of that. Without a doubt, and this has really gotten to me in my latter years, Hank Williams.
Yeah.
Hank Williams.
Hank Williams, he had a deep mind and lived through a lot of hell for a young man. And the songs are there as proof of that.
Yeah, obviously Kris Kristofferson, a lot of people don't talk about, now that I've got my head in that gear, a lot of people don't give Johnny Cash the credit he deserves as a songwriter.
Yeah.
And I tell you, and from a female standpoint, Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton's, especially her early songs, Dottie Rambo gets lit. I've said before that Dottie Rambo is the Hank Williams of gospel music.
Oh, I agree with that. And I say as a songwriter too, and we're mostly talking about songwriters that are also, you know, that had careers as singers. I mean, of course, there's the Hank Cochrans of the world.
And Merle Haggard.
Yeah. But I'll tell you someone that I've thought about lately because he passed away. But, you know, I think about a lot of the, especially the ballads. Jimmy Buffett was a great songwriter. And I hate that, you know, it's too bad that there are a lot of songs that he's known for that's labeled him. The guy was a fantastic songwriter.
Yep,
and a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know. I've always wondered that as who you were listening to as a songwriter and not, you know, maybe just a guitar slinger or a singer.
Right. Well, you know, like on that, that's where you got Vince Gill. You know, Vince Gill should be banned. I literally remember watching him sink a putt with a Telecaster at a thing I was at in Nashville. You know, he hit it with the back end of a Telecaster and sank a like 8-foot putt. Yeah, and it's like, what? You know,
the guy is a singer, songwriter, guitar player. He could have been a PGA Tour player.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. My big Vince story is that when I was a kid, we were up in Nashville and we went to the Nashville Palace a few times. And one night I got up and sang with the band. I was probably 9 or 10 years old. And Vince was there and came up to us after I sang and just told me how much he enjoyed it. And we walked outside with him to his car. He didn't have to be nice to the little novelty kid that just sang, but he was, and I still remember it, you know.
Yep.
You know, they say don't meet your heroes, but sometimes you do, and they leave a positive impact on you.
Well, I was that way when we opened for Jerry Reed, because I knew what Jerry Reed was famous for, and that was not always being the most amicable dude. And I'd been to the Chet convention where every time you say the word Chet, you're supposed to genuflect, you know. And I'd say some of that. Well, next thing I know, I get to spend the day with Jerry Reed. And I'll admit, I was a little bit pensive about it at first. And we got in there, and it was like he was having one of his best days ever. His manager said, "You've hit the lottery. He's feeling great. He's breathing well." And we spent the whole day. He was hanging out in our dressing room telling us stories. And we ate lunch together. We shot the bull. The only reason we didn't go out and fish was he told me this: the heat of the day and his emphysema, he wouldn't be able to sing that night, you know. And that was just, you know, and so it's the same deal. You got to be careful when you meet those people you put on an unrealistic pedestal.
Yeah, that's it. Because it's unfortunately, sometimes, you know, they may not be in the mood
They're humans.
They're human beings. That's the deal. Yeah, that's it. So you moved to Nashville in, you said, what, 96?
96.
And was the plan, were you wanting to go up and try to get a deal or what were
you?
Oh,
yeah. I had got offered a kind of a deal in 1992, but I had enough sense that it was not a good deal, so I passed on it. And then I had some folks around the Blairsville area that wanted to back me and wanted to, you know, and they knew it was a risk. But I literally just couldn't deal with the fact that somebody had put that kind of money on me. Then if it didn't pan out, even though they said there was no strings, in my mind, I really didn't like knowing I was beholden to people for that kind of money. So I said, I'll try it again. Well, then I got sick in 1994.
Yeah.
And so that cost me my chance to go back then. And then I went in 96. And I always told people, I know I talk, but I choose my words too. I told people I went to see if I could make it. I didn't go there to make it. And I got my answer. And then and because of the company that I worked for, I never told these people that I was into music. I made a mistake of telling my boss and I got lit up. I said, okay, I get it. So I'll tell anybody, if you're going to Nashville to get into music, wherever you work your day job, don't talk about that you have any interest in music. If they ask, tell them you're tone deaf and you keep time like you've got the shakes. But the job I got to working for a lot of these music people in Nashville, and I just listened and I listened and I learned. And Dwayne Rowe, who is just another dear soul, he told me one time, and Terry Crisp, they both told me they had never seen anybody come into Nashville knowing I knew one person, and that was Dennis Brown. And that's where that was my start. And they both told me the same thing. They had never seen anybody come to Nashville not knowing a soul, without a backer, to get in as deep and as quick as I did to the Knockers. I mean, my first CD that I did was Terry Crisp, Paul Hollowell, Scotty Hawkins, Larry Franklin. I mean, I don't remember some of the other, but it was the who's who at the time. you know, and I started getting to know these guys. And then I started learning the business because of some of the people I worked for downtown. And I learned what it was really, I learned the business side of it. I knew John Gerard, who wrote all those songs for Alabama from Gainesville. I knew Bruce Birch, and John Gerard gave me the best advice ever. And I wrote a song about it. It's on my second CD. It's called There Ain't No Hillbillies in Nashville. And he told me, he said, what you do is great. He said, you've got it figured out. He said, right now, it's not what's popular in Nashville. He said, so you either play the game and wait, and hopefully your time on the wheel comes up and you get to do it. He said, and you play these games, or you just pack your stuff and go to the house. He said, that's just how it is. So I hung around for a while, and I started seeing where Nashville was going. And I also realized that it was not going to be fortuitous for a family at that age. And if I didn't know what was coming on, I might have just got on the bus. But I realized that the music business was a good way to be broke beyond your wildest dreams and be bankrupt, deeply bankrupt, before you were 30 years old. And it was the heart. I cried my eyes out the day we left Nashville driving the U-Haul truck. And I flipped a bird out the window of the truck right at the 12th Street Bridge as I left.
Adios, Nashville. Yeah. It's, you know, it's probably just broken as many hearts as Las Vegas. You know, I mean, it's, and I, you know, I've served my sentence up there like you did. And I mean, I learned a whole lot, but at the end of the day, I just don't know if it wasn't the town for me. And that's all right.
Well, and that's what I realized. I got there about 3 years late. What I was into was it 3 years earlier. And these guys, the best friends you can ask for in life are the ones that will tell you the truth, not what you want to hear.
Yep, that's
and
it.
Terry and Dwayne both told me, they said, if you'd have stayed here, and I'll come to, this makes me think of, I wanted to make sure I say here in a minute. They both told me, they said, if you'd have stayed here, you would have made it in some form. But not because I'm the greatest at any one thing. It's the way I put it all together. I am not the greatest guitar player. I am not the greatest singer. I'm not the greatest songwriter. But I put it all together really well. And Kenny Head, who I just adore, told me, he said, I'm the front man of the century. And, you know, and on that note, if anybody that ever went to Nashville should have made it, it was you.
Oh, man. Well, I appreciate that.
And it's just like, but I've learned what the problem, one of the problems I had, I didn't fit a box, because like, you know, all the different places I've been, I didn't fit any of them. I mean, they were pitching me around. Nobody could figure where to pigeonhole me. And then I had enough sense to know when to sign off on some compromises, but I wasn't willing to sell out. And there is a difference. And it just hit me. My biggest issue I was too honest. And Terry Crisp told me, and John Gerard told me, they said, you went to college, you've got a degree, you can do anything you want to do, and you're smart. You see through there, again, they were talking about how fast I learned the business for the 90s. And they both said, the problem you've got is you're too smart for this. And the people that they make stars are the people that aren't that and will do whatever they're told. And I've learned as I've gotten older, they were right.
I cannot imagine the how challenging and difficult it has to be to try to get a deal in 2024. I just can't even imagine.
No. Well, when I was there, I did some work for, I guess I can say, I did some work for a guy named John Mason. And he was explaining, I was listening to how they set up deals, and they were explaining how they front the money to the act. When you get signed to a deal, you get fronted so much money that's to cover the bus and the band and the first three CDs and da-da-da. And after the first CD, they look at how much you made off of it. And if you made a decent amount, they'll go on and do the second CD. And if you didn't, okay, the deal's over. But now guess what? We fronted you all this money. You owe us this. So you either pay it back or you get banished to the circuit, the country fair circuit. I'm not knocking that, but that's how you're supposed to pay off your debt while you're incurring more costs.
That's it.
And it was just a different bag. And I remember I was under a desk there running some wires, and they were doing a contract for the artist. I learned that term this fall, and they were doing it. And the comment was made, well, if he signs this, it's going to cost him $40,000. And the answer was made, he's an old Okie. He won't have a clue what he's doing. He'll never miss it. And I'm thinking, okay, it's just how it is. And I started looking at the math on it. I watched some guys that had lost their deal. And I saw another artist in that same office who was one of the hottest artists in the business, iconic, 5 years earlier there. And she was crying to the point she had Tammy Faye, what's her name, Baker, makeup pouring off her eyes, begging him to find her another record deal. Yeah. And I'm thinking, you're a house. I can't name the artist because everybody knows that person. And she just faded off into the sunset for the most part. But I remember that I was there long years ago.
It's so heartbreaking. I mean, it's, you know, it's just, it's one of those things, man. It's people just go with dreams and look, some people make it, some people do really well, but it's a challenge to survive. It's unreal. You know?
Yeah, it is. And the only myth that I told people that you hear about Nashville that I found to not be true, that's why I call it a myth, is you hear about all these really great, you know, you hear the thing, there's 1,000 guitar players on street corners, they're as good as you've ever heard, 1,000 singers, blah. No, they're not. Those great people are making it. They're working. Now, there's a lot of really good people there that didn't make it, but the great people that worked and chopped it up in the whole bit, they're doing it. They're there. So that's another, that was one of those other, the other myth. Oh, if you move to the big bad city, they'll just eat you alive. No, they didn't. They reward you strictly on what can you do.
Yeah. If you can do it, if you can play or sing and you show up prepared and you're easy to work with, you will get hired. I mean, it happens.
And if you can ride on a bus for 3 weeks and not get in a fight, not stay stoned out of your mind and stay prepared, you can have a long career really doing well.
Don't you think it's time you came in from the cold and dared to warm your heart again? Leave his lies behind you and ease some of your fears. Share some smiles together. Let me wipe away your tears and breathe upon the embers and turn them into coals. We start a flame together and come in from the cold. Don't you think it's time you came in from the cold?
So tell me about this new album. Where did you cut it, and who all's playing on it, and where? Tell me about some of the tunes.
The title of the CD is A Place I've Never Been Before, and I wrote this 2009 and 2010. In addition to going simultaneously through a divorce, the bank that I was the CIO of and a vice president, it was also failing. And so the FDIC took it all down. And we literally failed in March, and my divorce was going on right then. It was a really bad time. And I was supposed to sing at church one Sunday. And with all due respect, there wasn't a whole lot in the hymn book or the other stuff that really said what I was dealing with. So I wrote this song and sang it I wrote it on Saturday night and sang it on Sunday morning. That's the title track, A Place I've Never Been Before. And I never really had the courage to sing it because it's so personal. And, you know, it doesn't make a club mix. And you can't line dance to it. I just kind of kept it to myself, but I started doing it in my solo acts, and it immediately caught traction. So finally got to go to a studio and do this. And I did it at Sound Kitchen. And I want to plug these guys because I was in so far over my head with the quality of people I was there with, but they treated me like I was important. And it was awesome. But I recorded it at Sound Kitchen Studios, Studio 19 there in Nashville. Kyle Hirschman, the wonder kid, he should have a propeller just drilled into his head. He's a genius. He was an engineer. And then the musicians, and I mentioned a couple of these names earlier, but I don't know if you remember, Dwayne Rowe lived right next door to us.
I do remember Dwayne.
Yeah. And Dwayne came in and filled a couple of times for us at the fair.
Yep.
He was Brooks and Dunn's band leader. I think he was. I'm pretty sure their whole big ride. And he played with Brooks and Dunn for however many 20 years. I don't know. And lived to tell about it. And now he's playing with Clint Black.
Okay.
And I've seen him with Clint, man. It is it's just so. But I've stayed in touch with him because we were next door neighbors. I would mow his yard sometimes when he was gone for a while. We were just, you know. So he played on my second. He played and produced my second CD, which is called The Smoky Mountain Man. But I've just stayed in touch with him, so I finally got to do this. So he played on it, and he helped produce it he produced it, and I gave him a little bit of spot in there. But Dwayne played piano, all the organ keyboards. Steve Henson played the steel guitar and all the slide and the dobro. And Dwayne and all of these guys are just freaking giants. But I didn't realize I knew the name Steve Henson. Of course, I knew what all Dwayne had done too. But after I got to know these guys, Steve and I found out literally, we counted about 70 something people we all knew equally well and hadn't ever met each other. And it was all based out of, most of it's all based out of Georgia music, you know, and he and I have just hit a great friendship off. Matt McGee played bass. And he's just, oh, my word, Andy. I don't know. You ever heard of Andy Hull?
Yeah, I think so.
He plays with Clint Black, and he plays with everybody that's got any sense. Andy Hull is a freaking drum machine. He makes a metronome look like it stutters. Scott Newbert, who I actually knew him through Dennis, he played on it. Jason Roller did background vocals and electric guitar on the final track, is a track called We Need Jesus. And by the time we got to that track, I was brain dead. I could not think what I needed to play for that song. I just couldn't get it to come out because it didn't need to sound like the Allman Brothers, you know. And so I pitched that to Dwayne, knew him, and pitched it to him. And then I do the lead vocals. I do electric guitar and acoustic guitar on the tracks as well.
Oh, cool. All right. I was going to ask you about that.
There's four covers and there's 13 originals.
Wow. How long did it take to cut all those?
That's where we crunched this thing. Now, again, hats off to Dwayne because he is a musical genius. I sent him the songs. He did all the prep work, the charts and all that. And we cut all of the, now there's three tracks on there that are just me and an acoustic guitar. So that was later on. But we cut all of the studio tracks in one day.
Wow.
We did three sessions.
Wow. And look, those guys they're masters at that, cranking out and just nailing it when the light turns on. But that's a lot of material.
And the thing they did, and I asked them, I said, how do y'all do this where the songs don't sound like the studio tracks you did the day before? And of course, they all laughed. They said, that's what the charts are for, you know, ha ha ha. But when we got there, they asked me, they said, well, how do you want these songs? I said, you're the guitar player. You're the steel player. What, play what you feel. I said, you get, and they all looked at me like I was from Mars. And they said, really? I said, no, dude, play what the song, you hear the lyrics. I sang scratch demos with them, which they told me helped them. That way they could tell the feel of the song, you know.
Yeah,
and they sat down and it wasn't like canned tracks. It was like, you can hear it in the product.
And yeah, it's so funny to me how people will go do a package deal like that and hire session players and pay all this money to do it and then micromanage what they want them to play. It's like, no, that's why you hired these people. Yeah. Let them do their thing.
That's like telling the neurosurgeon what part of your brain you want left alone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So did you go back and do the vocals in the same studio or did you do the vocals somewhere else?
I did all of it there. I don't have even though I'm a technological person, I don't have a studio set up in my room. So I went up and did 2 days of studio work, the one with all of them. Then I came back and did some of my overdubs. Then I took the rough tracks home and went over them. And now I've had it long enough. I wish I'd have gone over them a lot more. But then I went back up for two more days later on and sang the final vocals and sang some of the final tracks.
That's great. And you have it available as a CD.
Yeah.
And I think, did you tell me you're gonna release it to some of the streaming platforms as well?
Yeah, I didn't want to, but it's a combination of things, and not to make everything so political. I'm so sick and tired of everything being a controversy. You know, God, it's just so divisive. But the business side is, I've got this money in this project, and I'm the weakest link on it, and that's how my secret to success is always be the weakest link. That's what I do. This project is incredible. I just happen to be part of it. And I've got money in it because I did it right. I didn't do it in a garage in some house in Copper Hill, Tennessee, you know. And so I need to move the product, and it's done very well at concerts. But my point is, I've been hesitant to release it to iTunes or whatever because of what the percentage they take of the cut. And I get the business end of it. They've got the distribution. They've got the outlets. So I've been trying to do it a different way, but I've decided, and let me start, not all iTunes. The other thing I learned, and I worked with Pat Coyne. I don't know if you know him or not. Pat Coyne knows, I think he knew all four presidents on Mount Rushmore. I'm pretty sure. He knows everybody from his day in the music. But he did my CD. He duplicated my CDs. And we were talking about it. And the bottom line is most people don't use CDs anymore. So I did some thumb drives up, but people carry it around on their phones. And 90% of the people I've dealt with do not comprehend how to get music from a thumb drive or their CD to their phone through iTunes or whatever program. It's all they click on iTunes and download it, and then they carry it around. So I've kind of decided to give up some of the ghost there just to make it more accessible to people. They can click on iTunes, and I'm working on that. I'll talk to you about it. I will get your help. I'm going to try. I've got to get this thing out on iTunes in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, you know, and I get it. I mean, I played in a band here across the wide, and you know, the band released a couple of albums while I was playing with them, and that's it. You want to get a return on your investment for the production, and then the duplication of the record. But ultimately, the world we live in now, it's a streaming and a everything. It's accessible all the time, and that's just kind of
what
it is.
You don't get squat for streams. Well, get a thousandth of a cent. I think that's right.
That's why so many bands and artists are touring now, I think, is because that's selling merch and ticket sales. That's the way a lot of these groups are. That's how they're making money these days. It's just heartbreaking.
Right. Well, I remember in the 90s, and again, I won't name the artist, but I got a chance to audition for, and she was a major star. But most of the songs she was doing, she didn't write. So the way she made her money was touring, because the mechanicals of selling CDs, if you didn't write it, you weren't getting the lion's share, you know.
Right.
And I get it. I understand. And that is one of my pet peeves, is that the publishing laws have not caught up with what's going on in the business. Songwriters are getting screwed in all platforms, not just country music. Songwriters are getting screwed right now.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. They're going to have to figure something out. It's because it's becoming more difficult to make a living. A lot of people that are really good at their craft are going to go elsewhere. And, you know, I hate to see that the art is going to suffer as a result of it.
And when we were coming up, the business end of it, I knew a guy in Nashville that got a cut on a Garth Brooks album. And when we lived there, if you could get a cut on Garth or Reba, your house was paid for, whether it got played on the radio or not, because of the sheer mechanical sales of the CDs. Now people buy the hit. They buy that one or two singles. They don't buy the whole CD. So if you get a cut on an album, you may not see anything off of it except for what limited CDs. And like my automobile is a 2019, doesn't even have a CD player in it.
Yeah, mine doesn't either.
You know,
it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just hope, you know, I think I've said this before on this podcast. I know you and I probably sound a lot like the two old guys on the Muppet Show as we sit and talk about this.
What was it, Waldorf, and what was the other guy's name?
Yeah, I can't remember. Can't remember his name. But I do hope for our kids' generation's sake that they get this figured out and the artist can make some money. So
that's my thing is the artists, you know, the writers, and the Screen Actors Guild, the script writers, they can go on strike and it shuts everything down. What would happen if the songwriters just quit?
Yeah, I don't know.
And the reality is there's so many people out there dying to get in, they just walk in the door. Okay, we'll write songs for you. And the art might suffer. Who knows? It might be really revolutionary. But, you know, it's going to take something like that. And again, I'm not talking, I have no desires. I've quit chasing it, to quote Steve there again. I'm just trying to make some good art and leave something permanent for my kids to say, you know what, Dad had some pretty good ability. And my friends to say, you know what, there was a whole lot more to him than duck walking and playing a guitar behind his head. and you know what? He did do something besides play all that shit. But for the other artists that really, I mean, I don't make my living with music. I supplement it. You know, it's a hobby. It's not a hobby. It's an avocation that does fortunately pay for itself. What you and I have done with this is way more than a hobby. Hobby is crochet. But for the people that really do make a living, they don't have a chance if this doesn't change.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
It'd be like instead of paying somebody to paint your house, I'm just going to buy a bunch of spray cans and spray it on myself because it looks the same in the dark, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's And I think it's such a widespread problem. And I just think most of the consumers don't realize how much of an issue it is. You know, right. It's just, you know.
Well, and, you know, and like you say, because I've been working on this. I got a friend named Josh Rouse who does a blog, and he wrote one about not becoming, and I will probably mispronounce this word, but I'm trying not to become a curmudgeon. Is that the word?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want to become that old coot that if it ain't new or if it ain't old, it's crap. Because honestly, there was some old music that was pretty bad too.
Yeah.
That country music has been through pop before. This is not new. They changed Ray Price's way of originally singing. He went from sounding like Hank Williams to Ray Price. You know, this has happened before. So I refuse to go into that rabbit hole of if it ain't old, it's crap. No, I'm not doing that. And I refuse to become negative and pessimistic about it. But what I'm hearing right now, it is just so mundane and repetitive.
Formulate,
and the main thing, yeah, is it's fake. People are writing songs about places living in dirt roads and trucks when they've never been out of downtown.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. That's the way I feel the same way about it. It's just,
I finally remember the song that first time I heard Jerry Braswell sing Danny Boy.
Yeah,
that
it's was like it, you just stop in your tracks and you're like, what is happening? Yeah,
that entire building stopped. People out on the grass stopped. People driving down the hill in their cars stopped. And that's what it's about.
That's what it's about, man. Well, I want to ask you this. The last question I have for you, I've been trying to think today about how I wanted to ask you this question, because you and I we have another thing in common with each other that's very special to me, and I know it's special to you, in that we've had opportunities to get to play music with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know what that experience is like for you, getting to be on stage with JC.
Yeah.
And if you can put it into words, how that felt getting to do that.
Well, if I had to pick one word, and this will sound like it's talking about me, but I'm not. But for me, it was immortality. Because I remember when Chief was dying and he was talking, I went and talked to him and I told him, I said, you need to understand. And I named myself and several other people that he had had influences on. And you can think of people this would apply to you. I said, you need to understand that as long as I'm breathing and playing guitar, you're still playing the guitar. Because he was such an influence on me. And there's other people, Billy Puckett, you know, people, not just the big stars, but the people that run our lives. And I watched JC over there playing. And the first thing when she plays, it's my tone. It's, and as a lot of people don't know this, but tone's in your hands. And JC's playing a different guitar, a different amp, but it sounds like my tone. And this isn't just my word. It's other people that have heard it. And then when she graduated from high school, she went out on the field and played the national anthem with the president. And she used my Orange Sparkle Telecaster, and it sounded like my tone. Her tone in her hands is identical to mine, to the point where we're playing some events together. It disorients me. I hear this lick played, and I thought, I did not play that. And I look around and she's got this grin that, you know, so from that part, it's like, I know through her, I'm going to outlive me.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is she is so, I don't know that she'll pursue all this because she's 18, you know, but if she decides to go after this, she could be exponentially better than I am because she has that ability. And she has the drive and she has the want to. Now, right now she's got to pass college, you know. She's got other things in front of her. I also firmly believe music has chosen her, so she'll come back to it in some form. But the other part of it is when she's playing stuff I don't know, because she's looking at it already. She's an old, old soul, but she's already looking at even those old songs in ways I've never seen them. And it's like this, not only I want my kids, I want Jameis and JC both to be better than I could have ever imagined me being. That's the goal. But when you watch her in the music case, when you watch her do this, and she interprets songs that you've never thought about. She plays stuff you never thought about. But when we play the song we've done, she'll put a twist on it that I never thought of. Even if it's the same lick, it's the different intensity. And when I watch them do that and I watch her go out on a stage, I mean, she's opened with me for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I'll watch her name. I cannot believe I'm forgetting names. Rhonda Vincent. I mean, she's gone out and she just kills it while we're out there. And everybody comes, does she ever smile? Well, yeah, she does. But when she's playing, she's intense. And watching her not, you know, freak out. So we're talking about like the variety nights. How many years did we see grown people walk out on variety night and just lose their chips?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and JC walks out on the stage with me year before last at 17. It's just me and her. We're opening for Rhonda Vincent and she kills it. And we go out and do the same thing for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, you know, kills it. And she's played with me at smaller events right here at the courthouse and all that. And it ain't like she's just a kid or she's my daughter. I mean, but if she couldn't do this, I wouldn't set her up for failure. She goes out there and pulls it off. It's not like she's just there because dad brought me. I wouldn't have her out there if she couldn't do it.
Yeah, that's the way. I understand that's the same way I have always been with Skylar. It's not a novelty, and I wouldn't set him up for failure. He's out there because he deserves and has earned his spot out there.
Yeah. And the beauty of all of it, the way this all works together, is that like your kids and my kids, to me, that there's a part of them belongs to us. If Skylar called me and said, hey, can you help me do this? It's going to happen because of that bond with music. If JC was doing an album, said, hey, you think we could get Brad? I'll tell a cool story, right? But I say, you think we could get Brad to play on it? That's the part. That's the trickle down of from Howard to Bill to us, you know.
That's it.
And I took JC when she was 16. I took her on a 3-day whirlwind trip. We went to Fame and Muscle Shoals, and then we went to Nashville. And we're walking around in Fame Studio, and I'm not knocking Studio B or the Elvis Studio, but it felt sterile. It's been so over toured. It was, and yeah, there's the X where Elvis stood, and that was just piano. And that's where he shot a hole through the cab. You know, okay, I loved all that, and that was pretty heady stuff. But we walked in Fame, and there was a vibe in there that was palpable. So we're walking around, and JC's looking at all of it, and she's not talking a lot. And she looks at me, and she says, "You know what would be really fun?" I said, "What?" "To come in here and do a studio and get Kenny and Gary to play on it with us." That was that trip.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it's I have way more. I have so much pride watching my kids play and sing. It's just to me that's way more important and way better than anything I would have ever been able to do as a musician, is just getting to sit and watch them. It's just unbelievable.
And that's kind of how I was about that variety night. And the variety night went away because the world has changed and we were having kids aren't like our kids are playing because their parents are musicians, but kids aren't playing like they were when we were growing up because they're getting it off of iPad. I get all that. But that was one of the fun things, especially because prior to the single night was the kids' day. And getting to pass some of this along to kids, and you could tell the ones that really wanted it and the ones that didn't. You know, you could tell the difference between the pageant kids and the music kids, and trying to help them out and help them bring them along, you know, and pass this along. And that's pretty much where I've gotten in life in general. My favorite part is passing this along, not just to kids, but to other adults. And I've give up. When I say give up, I've quit chasing it. I have no hopes or false hopes of ever getting known. I mean, it'd be cool if I got a song cut or something like that just for that part of it. But my thing now is I want to try to find people I can pass this along, just like those guys we talked about passed it along to us.
Yeah, that's a theme. It comes up a lot on this podcast, and is that we were very lucky and we were the beneficiaries of people before us that paved the way for us as musicians and then hired us youngsters or mentored us youngsters
and put up with us,
right? They could have been territorial about it, and they could, but no, they wanted to just tell us stories about stuff they've done and play a song with us. And man, we got a music education that you can't go and get at a university, you know?
It doesn't, I'm sorry, it doesn't exist anymore. We got the tail end of the last real legends.
I agree.
And, you know, it's like the Hank Williams thing. I made a comment the other day. Is there an adult alive that's an adult now that remembers seeing Hank Williams live? Or is there an artist? And the only one I know of is Brenda Lee, because I have seen a picture. I can't find it. I got to find it. But I've seen a picture of Brenda Lee as a kid on a package show with Hank Williams Sr. All right. Yeah. The reason I'm telling that is I got to open for Ray Price twice. That is the crowning moment. Well, I'll tell you that. I got to tell you the other part. That is the crowning moment of my commercial career, and getting to hang out, because the first time it was just random. The second time he asked for us, and that's all the endorsement I needed. But I was standing there working a show with a guy who was Hank Williams' roommate.
Yeah.
So I'm 1 degree away, you know. And that's, and it's, and back to the tolerateness. When I started playing Clogging Day, which was the Appalachian equivalent of waterboarding, for those that don't know, Clogging Day started at 9 a.m. and went till about 2 a.m. And the only time we broke was for lunch because of the parade, and then they let us eat. There were so many people. Well, I was new, and I was wanting to really play because I knew these songs. I'd learned them. And so we're playing Alabama Jubilee. Well, I'd learned this song. I learned the Jerry Reed hot lick, just showing my ass version. So Howard plays this part. Bill plays his part because we're passing this around so we can all live. Chief plays his part, and I come to my part. And Howard looks at me and just goes, shakes his head left and right. Like, you idiot. And I thought, and Chief leans me out, that's not how we play it. I'm like, well, nobody told me that. I thought you were supposed to play what, you know. And and they said, no, just play the melody, because all it's about is keeping the time so the cloggers don't lose beat. So I bailed out of the Hot Licks version and went right back to 4-H, you know, playing the single note version. But the discipline I learned from playing those songs like that is what really set me to the next level.
That's it. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And they could have immediately said, you know, to hell with you. You don't get this. You know, but that was my first time out. I didn't do it again.
Right.
But that those guys, Brad Paisley's got a song, What's Something of the Hands. It's about the guys. It's about the guy that started him, and then Chet Atkins, Steve Warner. It's a duet. And you need to check that out. It's Calloused Hands or something like that. And it is exactly what we're talking about. It will just break your heart. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I consider myself just undeserving of getting to be mentored by the Bill Cunninghams and the James Childers of the world. Mm-hmm. They're giants in my mind, you know.
And then some other people that I met through this, like Sonny Thomas. Mm-hmm. Sonny Thomas is a guitar playing legend, and for some reason, well, he and I kind of looked at the world with a little bit of irreverence, and we just hit it off, and we were super close. And right before he died, he didn't know he had a stroke and died, but I went and picked up a guitar about 3 months before that happened, and we were leaving. He put his arm around me. He said, you know, he said, I just love you. And
that's awesome.
His wife said, he doesn't tell people that. And it's just like, and the people like that, Billy Puckett, you know, and another great story, Howard Cunningham, last public performance was playing a square dance with me at Woody Gap Gymnasium in Sutches, playing the fiddle. And that was his last. And he rode home with me. I drove because he couldn't drive by then. His dementia was pretty serious. He and Jameson and I rode in my truck back to Hiawassee, and he told stories back the entire night about all of this.
Oh, that's great.
And that is a long, long ways from the same school that a 9-year-old started playing square dances. And I do. I feel the most blessed in the world. I get to, like you. I mean, we're not going to leave you out of this. You know, I would not know you. And back to our accomplishments. My crowning accomplishment was being asked to put the music and the program together for Howard's funeral. I struggled after that, finding out what did I really want to do with music. I'm done, because so much other stuff was going on that was superficial. And I really had a hard time coming back to reality. Okay, you need to find something else to do. But I wouldn't know you without all of that, you know, the things we've been through together. Yeah. And I'm like you. I feel so undeserving, because I know I'm not the best of most of these people we've talked about. I'm a really good me, and that's what stuck.
Yeah, I just, and I know a lot of it for me is getting older, and, you know, just you kind of look at things at a 30,000 foot view a little bit more, I think, mm-hmm. as time goes on. And mm-hmm. I just, unfortunately seeing people pass away, I mean, it brings a lot of it into perspective. Oh. And I, you know, I just,
it's so hard to. I sent this message to one of the Oak Ridge boys because, you know, Joe Bonsall's retiring. And I sent a message to Dwayne the other night. Like, I know him. I don't know him. We're just friends on Facebook. But they do respond. So I guess that's better than, you know. But I sent him a message one night. And I watched this with Howard, because when he started handing this over to me, the last night we did it, when he handed it over, we sang Will the Circle Be Unbroken. And Howard stood up there beside me and sang his heart out. Now, Howard was not a singer, but it didn't matter. He sang his heart out. And I was watching this, and that's when I came up with this idea. And I told Dwayne about with the Oak Ridge boys. It's so hard to watch your heroes fade.
Yeah, it is.
whether it's our parents or other musicians, it's so hard to watch. And it's kind of our job now. And who's going to fill their shoes? Nobody. Nobody feels so. That's unfair. It's just who's going to step up to take the next spot.
That's it. That's right.
And now it's our time. And that's what I'm trying to find a way to be the next person that helps some 9-year-old kid from a little bitty town with 100 school kids total. And all of a sudden he's in the Atlanta Country Music Hall of Fame, you know?
Yeah.
And I've been so close on so many times. But I finally came to some peace with that too. If you made it in your heart doing what you set out to do, you made it.
That's it.
Don't let them, the ubiquitous they, I don't know who they is, but I'd like to hunt them down and kick their ass. But don't let they determine what your success ratio is.
That's it. No, that's exactly it. Well, buddy, in my eyes, you are a freaking success story and one of my best pals in the world. And I'm honored to know you, call you my friend, and to have played a whole lot of great music together over the years. And I just love you to death.
Well, thank you. And it is, as Bill Cunningham likes to say, it's mutual. I think about it again, back to the music thing, what we would all do for each other outside of music. The best part of music is the relationships we build.
Yeah.
Kenny Head and I've talked about this. There's a core of us that are that way. And I'm honored to be on here with you because I know I've known a lot of musicians through the years, and there's a handful that I would endorse fully to any environment, to anybody, with no regret of it ever shining back on me. And you are definitely one of them. And to be included in this with you is another one. That's a check mark in my life. So I'm grateful beyond words.
Go check out Jim's music. Go listen to him.
JimWoodMusic.com.
JimWoodMusic.com. Go check him out. He's awesome. I love you, Jim Wood.
I love you too, Brad. You're the absolute best.
When I'm gone, will you wanna hug and kiss me all night long? Will you miss the mess I make, sopping gravy off my plate? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Will you miss seeing my stuff thrown everywhere, or the way I ran my fingers through your long blonde hair? My recliner patch with tape, me and an old yard rake. Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Will you wanna hug and kiss me all night long? Will you miss the mess I make, sopping gravy off my plate? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Shows in Nashville in my soul. I love the Allman Brothers Band. Hank Williams is the man. People, will you miss me when I'm gone? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Will you wanna hug and kiss me all night long? Will you miss the mess I make, sopping gravy off my plate? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? My Savior's face, and we'll all stand and sing Amazing Grace. I don't think it will be long until we're all called home. I wonder, will they miss us when we're gone? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Will you want to hug and kiss me all night long? Will you miss the mess I make, sopping gravy off my plate? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone? Will you miss the mess I make, sopping gravy on my plate? Honey, will you miss me when I'm gone?
Thanks for listening to the Bandwidth Tapes. I'm your host, Brad Williams. The show's theme is called Playcation and was written by Mark Mundy. Drop me a line at the email address, thebandwitchtapes@gmail.com. Make sure to subscribe to receive new episodes of the podcast. And while you're at it, please tell someone else about the show. Thanks for listening.